Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. China finds itself in the middle of a trade war with the United States, with big ramifications for China's fast-growing economy, evidenced by the country's main stock exchange, the Shanghai, recently falling close to a four-year low. China has managed to avoid any military confrontation since taking on Vietnam nearly 40 years ago. But there are several scenarios that could heat up in that regard for Beijing, and most of them involve the U.S. Joining the Crisis Next Door to talk about this is Ray Zong, Program Assistant for the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S. Ray, thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
China's Xinjiang region is about as far removed from Beijing as you can get within China's massive landmass in the northwest corner of the country, filled with deserts and mountains, and a host of ethnic groups, primarily the Turkic Uyghurs. While the Uyghurs have long had to deal with suppression from the Chinese government, the crackdown has been even more forceful since 2009 when massive riots broke out in Xinjiang. Security is heavier, internet censorship has risen, and Uyghurs and other Muslims have been banned from growing beards or wearing Islamic clothing. Ray, what exactly does Beijing fear from the Uyghurs? Why these big crackdowns?
Government media issued like a 15-minute or so propaganda documentary that essentially asserted that they feared the spread of extremism within Xinjiang. And so that is their ideological basis for setting up the sort of carceral systems as well as the technology-based surveillance and other policing programs within the province. So we've been seeing very strong language on the need to both contain and prevent the spread of what the Chinese government considers to be the extremism that will endanger its national security.
How legitimate is the fear in Beijing that men who may have traveled to fight for Islamic fundamentalists in Syria are going back to Xinjiang and possibly stoke resistance against Beijing?
Well, China's certainly gotten more active in trying to participate in multinational anti-terrorism and anti-extremism campaigns, and we've certainly seen it adapt the language and the policy standpoint that Xinjiang's Uyghurs are going abroad to fight for extremist groups and returning. And there have been certain isolated incidents attributed to Uyghurs. However, the current numbers that there are mass incidents and mass cases of extremism and risks of violence, that has yet to be more solidly corroborated at this time.
Is it tougher for Islamic fundamentalists to recruit Uyghurs into their causes around the world? Obviously, China has got much more stringent censorship over social media than other parts of the world. And the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, they've really leveraged social media to get new recruits. Is this a problem for them in trying to get Uyghurs to join their cause?
I haven't specifically looked into how these groups have targeted Uyghurs, but in terms of how the Chinese government perceives it, one of the really early actions that a lot of China watchers point to that preceded the establishment of these camps was that the Chinese government started limiting overseas travel by people from Xinjiang. They took away their passports and set up more like you had to get more approvals to go abroad, and eventually that led to the establishment of increased police and security checkpoints throughout the province.
Is there any movement among the Uyghurs to effectively organize a resistance to Beijing in light of all of this?
Because of the degree of the increase in policing activities, China's government is essentially trying to sort of nip any opposition movements in the bud. And you have to understand that this is a country where public organization and things that challenge government sovereignty, that's something that they're very sensitive to in the first place. So for Uyghurs, which is a population that the majority Han ethnicity government already monitors, that's just not something that can very easily sort of organically form, especially in Xinjiang.
When you look at where Xinjiang is located, long borders with other countries, that there isn't much there in regards of infrastructure. Is that something tough for China to police as far as the comings and goings of anybody who might be able to come in and influence the Uyghurs or possibly help them in their resistance against the government?
The Chinese government sort of acknowledges that. It's always been very concerned about its peripheries, whether it's Xinjiang or its other, or its maritime peripheries. But what's been unique about both Xinjiang and I would also say Tibet, Qinghai, which is another large minority population, is that these peripheries are seen as regions where the government will send its officials and then see how they can sort of effectively police those sorts of regions. They do that by moving large amounts of police presence, and they also have a larger than usual sort of People's Liberation Army presence. So in terms of how they're able to police this remote region, it's by moving their most advanced resources there and by sort of flooding the region with Han ethnic security presence.
How critical is Xinjiang to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which includes tremendous infrastructure investments in countries like Pakistan?
Well, the province itself, it has a little bit of a sort of geographic significance, but in terms, and it certainly helps, it helps link China to the Central Asian states that it's currently engaging it with for the Belt and Road Initiative. But in terms of right now, I think it's mostly looking at Xinjiang as a more of a security issue than anything else.
The U.S. and European Union have spoken out against the Xinjiang crackdown. Do you think that matters at all to Beijing?
Beijing considers the issue an issue of national sovereignty, and I don't, as of right now, I'm not sure if anything the U.S. or the EU has done has stuck with the Chinese government.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about China with Ray Zong, Program Assistant for the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S. Turning to the east and south China's border by massive bodies of water, it's been extending its influence over the South China Sea and the East China Sea with a combination of economic desires and military control at the heart of it. There have also been several flybys, including U.S. B-52 bombers, over several bases that China has built in the South China Sea. Ray, it almost seems like a geopolitical game of chicken. Who do you think will blink first?
In terms of strategic importance, China has definitely considered, it's been building its maritime security resources for some time now, and also in the diplomatic front, it's been trying to engage with ASEAN to try to push its regional views there further. We are starting to see, because a lot of these military buildups, they're not just with China and the U.S., but it's a multilateral issue, which is a position that the U.S. government has consistently registered in official remarks.
And speaking of alliances, the U.S. this year also renamed its Pacific Command the Indo-Pacific Command, mm-hmm. with the hopes of bringing India on board to hem China in. How committed is India to doing that? Is China's Belt and Road Initiative involving its arch enemy Pakistan enough incentive for India to get more involved in helping the U.S. contain China?
India's relationship with China has always been particularly complicated because India and China recently had their own border slash periphery flare up in Bhutan, I think, that really sort of heightened tensions between the two. I'm not 100% sure on where they are right now in terms of India's maritime commitments, but we are starting to see India and other South and Southeast Asian countries explore different configurations of multilateral partnerships with Japan, with countries that haven't gotten along with China that great, like Vietnam. And so at a moment where we're starting to see these shake-ups in terms of regional influence, we're really starting to see each state's like trying to sort of wedge in its own national interests and try to get the most out of the situation.
Over in the East China Sea, the dispute this time is with historic enemy Japan over another group of islands called the Senkaku by Tokyo and the Diaoyu by Beijing. Japan has had control over the islands for well over a century, outside of a small time after World War II, but China has been looking to take control of the islands for decades. There have been more military flybys, but the two countries have also started a crisis communications hotline to avoid any accidental encounters. Ray, where does the Sino-Japanese relationship stand at this moment?
So the issue with Senkaku Diaoyu, I've always felt this has been more of a, like, neither China nor Japan wants to be the party that caves on it, but the island itself, it's not particularly economically valuable, so it is a little bit of a sort of game theory situation where neither one of them wants to be the one to cave, but also, like, just how much military or security on Japan's case, since they can't have a military, how many security resources are they willing to commit to it? That's always been the consistent question when it came to this particular dispute.
We've seen more of a rise in nationalism in Japan. Is that a concern at all for China?
Well, China's, like, nationalism by the average Japanese person, it's they give or take. The two sides have never really been, like, best friends in terms of international relations. What China is watching right now is Japan, how Japan is interacting with other countries in the Asia region, including with India. And also, they are watching carefully with how Japan is managing its alliance with the United States. China's never been super happy that America has a lot of military bases. Japan houses some of those military bases. The third thing that I think China is watching out for is that its Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is, he's always been on the more hawkish side and has signaled for the last couple of years that he wants to repeal a certain segment of the Japanese constitution, which will allow Japan to raise a military, which is, again, something that China would be deeply unhappy with. So nationalist feelings they can manage, but, like, in terms of what resources Japan has access to and what alliances it forms, that's, I think, more of a strategic concern for Beijing.
Taiwan has long been considered the most likely issue to trigger a military confrontation between the U.S. and China, and relations between Taipei and Beijing have been frosty. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen has repeatedly said that her country won't back down to pressure from China. What's China's long-term strategy here? What can it hope to accomplish?
Okay, so Tsai Ing-wen, who is the current president of Taiwan, she ran on a campaign to sort of maintain more of a status quo, whereas Beijing has been more eager to try to sort of work to integrate, economies and sort of cultures and more like institutions between Taiwan and the mainland. So this has been kind of a point of tension. The U.S. in all of this, we our government's sort of stance on this was based on something called the Three Joint Communiques, which essentially it means that we recognize that we recognize a sort of gray area identity here, and so but at the same time, there's also a certain degree of vested security interests in cross-strait relations.
Let's consider North Korea. Beijing will obviously play a key role in any nuclear disarmament by Pyongyang. But will U.S. trade tariffs on Chinese imports threaten those hopes in your mind?
I think one thing that that tends to be a misconception is that Pyongyang can take orders from Beijing, where it's kind of tricky. And also, Beijing is, although we have seen like more frequent visits and exchanges by top North Korean officials, including Kim Jong-un himself, the degree that China is able to push North Korea, that's a little bit up in the air. But on the economic side, we are starting to see Kim Jong-un take an interest in potential economic opportunities, and particularly with South Korea, as he and President Moon Jae-in are in a bit of a warming period. And since South Korea gets hit as a secondary effect by U.S. tariffs against China, I think if these tariffs continue to go into effect, they'll sort of bounce and impact how the U.S. is able to handle North and South Korea policy as well.
Given the potential confrontations all around the periphery of China, would you say the chances of a conflict with the U.S. are greater than they ever have been, or are they pretty much at a status quo?
I think right now we have definitely moved into an era of heightened competition. Military conflict or security conflict, it's still hard to say, because I think that, you know, despite stronger language by each side, there is still this recognition that a security conflict would produce a lot of very large-scale consequences. However, it doesn't mean that we won't see sharper sort of policy weapons via tariffs, via restrictions. This morning, the news dropped that the U.S. was imposing some kind of a postage restriction because of a perception that Chinese businesses were using cheap postage to flood the U.S. with underpriced goods. So we're going to be seeing a lot of different types of policy enacted that might get aimed towards China, but because of the size and scale of the U.S. economy, it's going to have international and global implications.
It's going to be interesting to see where all of this heads in the coming months. Ray, thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Crisis Next Door, and we've been talking about China with Ray Zong, Program Assistant for the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.